Hi, I'm Tim Brody, and you're listening to Moving Forward, a podcast about relationships, teams, and community. Today, we're chatting with Dan McNaughton. He's a Nova Scotian fellow with a heart of gold and a determination to serve. He's been a volunteer firefighter, a police officer, and ran as a candidate for provincial election. He spent almost 36 years in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. His career had challenges, tragedies, triumphs, and he did it all with the mindset to be a community guardian and servant. He's in his 60s now, but is not even close to being finished and leaving a positive impact and lasting legacy for his community, his friends, but most importantly, for his children. It was great hearing how his career started and the memories it's created.
Some members of the RCMP are speaking out against the organization right now. Dan, how does that hit you?
Well, it saddens me, quite honest. I mean, you know, and some, don't get me wrong, just because my experience was one thing, it doesn't mean that somebody else experienced the organization, you know, in as positive a note as I did. And don't get me wrong, there was ups and downs throughout my career as well. But it saddens me that there seems to be a groundswell of discontentness. I'm hearing it. I hear it when I talk to vets. So I guess I question those individuals too sometimes. I say, well, what was it that, what was the TSN turning point for you? What caused you to have these feelings? And then every time it's a legitimate feeling to them. I mean, I don't have the right to tell them how to feel, and I don't have the right to tell them that their experience wasn't sufficient enough for them to feel the way they do. But I do have the right to say, well, if you looked at it from through this lens, you might feel differently about it. Or if you looked at it from another angle, you might feel differently. I've always felt, number one, life is too short to go through it angry and depressed and pissed off at your employer or the career you chose. And so, even with the ups and downs of my career, I made a mental decision to leave the organization with my head held high, feeling that they certainly got their money's worth out of me, and I got my money's worth out of them. You know, there's so many things that I think are contributing to the discontent or, you know, the organization. Let's call it organizational discord. Can we use that word, Tim?
We can use both those words.
I think that people feel they're not being supported. I think that the members on the ground level don't feel that they're getting the support from the upper levels of management that they think they should be getting. Unfortunately, just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. So it doesn't mean that the upper levels of the management aren't supporting the membership just because they're not reporting on a daily basis what they did to support the membership that day. Having said that, there's a shift in the community as well. You know, there was a day when you put an RCMP member in Red Surge in a parade, and that was pretty much your community level assurance for the year. Everybody was happy, and there goes the Mountie, and they're here, and they're doing a great job, and we won't question that. Well, there's been a number of things that have led to, you know, policing in general, some of the policing practices in general being questioned, and members are scrutinized to a level of accountability that is heretofore unseen, in my opinion. I think policing is scrutinized at a level that it's never been historically. And, you know, some of the members are finding it difficult to, the criticisms are some of them are baseless, some of them aren't. And it's difficult sometimes to feel like you're the bad guy when really you thought you were you joined the good guys. And society seemed, I mean, you know, let's face it, back when we were kids, the good guys and the bad guys were clearly identified. That's not so clear anymore. Our heroes were clearly good guys. Well, today kids have heroes that arguably they might not be good guys, you know, and they might, you know, from our generation anyway. And so society's has shifted for good reason to ask questions and ask tough questions. And sometimes that's hard to deal with as a policeman on the ground.
Let's talk about where your wisdom came from and how it was percolated and developed. How many years did you have as an active member in the RCMP?
I'm just shy of 35.7 years, I guess.
And before that, you'd volunteer a firefighter.
That's correct. I was a founding member of the Waverly Junior Fire Department, which was founded back in the early 70s. mid-70s, and there was 14 of us, and we were hanging around the fire department, and we got together with one of the senior firefighters there and formed the junior fire department, and we actually learned about fighting fires and first aid and basically community service.
There was something in your DNA right from the start that said you need to serve.
I think so, Tim. I've always felt that way. I've always felt a need to contribute, you know, to my community or serve my community in a way. It was a calling, I guess. You know, that might sound a little dramatic, but I've always felt that calling. I don't remember a time in my life when I didn't want to do some form of service, whether it was the fire department or policing. And, you know, I decided at a very young age that I was going to be a policeman, in particular the RCMP. That organization appealed to me. And I never took my sights off that goal.
How old were you when you went to the RCMP?
Well, I actually applied for the RCMP when I was 18 years old. You couldn't be accepted at the age of 18, but you could apply when you're 18, and you couldn't be accepted till you were 19. And a very wise recruiter who interviewed me saw some, let's call it some maturity gaps, where he felt that I had excellent opportunity to maybe be a good police officer one day, but that wasn't the day. And so I was what was called deferred. So I was deferred to go get some life experience. I mean, I was still living at home. I had only had a couple serious jobs. And so he wanted me to go get some life experience. So I did that. And I reapplied when I was 21 and was accepted and was in training when I was 22.
Well, that's incredible that someone said to you, "Not yet, son, but one day."
And that was hard to hear at the time, you know, because again, probably making his point more than mine, because I stormed out of the room thinking, what does he know? I mean, whether how does he know it's not my time and all this stuff? I didn't storm out in front of him, but, you know, I'm thinking of myself when I drive home now. What does he know, you know? And when I thought about it, well, I still didn't agree with it. It never impacted my decision to eventually become a policeman. I thought, well, I'll just wait them out and try again. But to be honest with you, I don't know if I could have survived training when I was 19 years old. So I think he was exactly right. He saw something in me that was good, and he saw potential in me, but he also saw that probably wasn't a good time for me. And he was 100% right.
It's those harsh statements that create the spark that light the fire that demand you to think, do you really want this? And if you do, then you need to go for it full bore. But if you don't, this is your walk away point.
Sometimes it's the old, I'll show you.
Yes.
You know, because I had doubters in my life. I can remember, I can remember a friend of my dad's who was a good friend of our family. And I can remember telling him, yeah, I've been accepted in the RCMP. And he just kind of snickered and he said, you won't get through training. And I was taken aback by that. Yeah, I guess a little hurt probably. But I thought, I'll show you. And he was one of the first guys I went and saw when I graduated, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And you know, of course, his reply was, well, I knew you could do it. I just wanted to give you a motivation, right? And maybe he did. I don't know. But it worked.
So you're 22 and you arrive in Regina and you go into depot. What is it that's motivating you to stay that path even after someone has said, nah, not right? What's the big vision, the big goal that's driving you?
I've always been a big picture guy, Tim. I could see that this was going to be a very temporary inconvenience for a bigger purpose and a bigger picture. And there were days, I'll tell you, I mean, training, you know, every recruit will tell you that their training was the toughest. So I'm going to tell you my training was the toughest. It was difficult. It was not easy. I was not a physically gifted guy. I was lucky enough to be cognitively gifted, but not physically gifted. And so it was a struggle for me physically, but I can remember the first day I got there was February 15th, 1982. And I walked into the administration building and, you know, after having been sworn in. So in those days, we were already constables. So I had the rank of constable the day I started training. Today, of course, we have cadets who don't get become constables till they graduate. But in those days, I was a constable. So I felt pretty darn good about that. I'm already a constable and haven't done a lick of work yet. Mm-hmm. But I went in and I can remember I went and they issued me a box. They gave me a cardboard box with two pillows, a triangular bandage, and a pair of handcuffs in it. And they said, this is the first thing. So I go over to my dorm. And of course, you know, I was not used to dorm, any kind of dorm life. And I walked in and there was only six guys in the dorm. There was 16 beds down each side. No snoreboards between the beds, two beds pushed together and then a common area, two beds pushed together, 16 on each side. And the floors were gleaming, I remember, and everything was shining. And these guys were down at the end of the dorm. They kind of barely noticed me coming in. And I almost turned around and walked right back out the door. I thought, what the hell am I doing here, right? And at Reveille the next morning, I thought the same thing again. But again, I was able to focus on the bigger picture and get through training. And there were a lot of great times in training. There were a lot of tough times. It was not an easy, I can say for sure, it's the most difficult thing I've ever done was to not only survive, but flourish in the RCMP Training Academy.
What was that big picture that you were seeing that created the North Star to guide you through that?
Well, you know, I guess I'm a bit of an idealist. I could see myself helping people on an individual basis. I mean, you know, there's different levels of help, but there's very few, in my opinion, in professions where you actually have the ability to make a difference in an individual's life on a daily basis. And policing is one of them. And that was what I saw, as I saw, I have an opportunity here. So it might sound corny, but I saw an opportunity to put my thumbprint on society. I just thought, I felt I could do some good. I felt I'm going to be able to do some good here. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to lie. There's other things. I mean, you know, the fact that you're wearing a sharp uniform. There's recognition. There's respect that comes with you. All those things are things that you look forward to and appreciate. But if that's the only thing that's driving you, it will be pretty hard to survive.
It's interesting to hear your notion that it was about providing service to your community, because for folks that have that common experience with the police, you know, you're pulled over for speeding or you've been driving when you shouldn't have because you had a few drinks in your belly, or police have been called to your area where you're going to be seen in a certain perspective. They might not say police are there to service. They might say police are there to dominate us and they're on power trip. How does that blend with your perspective of why you joined the police?
Well, I guess, you know, some of that has to do with how you conduct yourself. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've come across power trippers and people who have been very, very confident in their roles as police officers and maybe not as respective. Not as respective of people's rights as they should have been, not as appreciative of the responsibility that they have. Mm-hmm. And that was never lost on me. You know, I can remember, you know, in one of my law classes and the law professor talking about, you know, in the police in Canada have the authority to take your liberty away from you for a short time or for a long time. And in a democracy, in a true democracy, that is a huge, huge authority that comes with an equally huge or even huger, if that's a word, responsibility. Call it idealistic, call it what you will, but that was never lost on me. So I put lots of people in jail. And there are not everybody that I met with over my career will tell you damn it, Norton was a good guy or a respectful guy or a great guy to get along with, because sometimes tough times call for tough interventions. But overall, I never lost focus on the fact that my job was a job of service, not a job of authority, not a job of enforcement, not a job of rule making and enforcing. My job was a job of community service. You talk about, well, what could possibly be a community service about issuing a traffic ticket? Well, maybe you save somebody from having a car accident or injuring somebody else. What possibly could be a community service from taking an impaired driver off the road? Well, clearly, you know, we know that carnage is caused on the highways by impaired driving. So it is a service. Not everybody likes the service, especially when you're on the other end of it. But it is a service.
There you were at 22 with this noble vision, and you used it as part of your motivator to get through a really difficult experience in depo and in the police form of basic training. During your career, what's that one particular moment when you said, see, this is exactly why I joined?
But you know, Tim, there's a time that comes to mind where a little fella had been out ATVing with his father, and they didn't come back on time. And eventually the mother reported them as missing, and so we went and did a search, and we found them. And the father had unfortunately suffered a fatal heart attack. And here's this little guy with his dad, right, waiting. I mean, I'm sorry, because it's emotional, but the little guy is waiting with his dad, doesn't know what to do. And so I spent a lot of time with him because we had to transport things like that. And in his obituary, the fellow's obituary, you know, they put a very nice quote the guy's life, and then she put a paragraph on the end saying, "We owe a deep amount of thank you and respect for Constable Dan McNaughton for his relationship with Curtis." Long story short is this family took the time to acknowledge what I did with that young man during probably the worst day of his life. And they really, really, really appreciated it. And I had a relationship with that young fellow for quite a few years after that. That was a hugely rewarding thing for me. It's pretty raw for me. It was one of those things that you never forget. And it gives you a feeling, even though it was a horrific situation, a feeling of goodness that you unless you felt it, you can't explain it.
Man, you've obviously had an incredible career. And I know from where I'm sitting, a great number of people use your examples as their guiding way when they're having a tough time. So you've done that for police in general and the RCMP as a whole. I'm wondering where you had to rely on team members around you, where if it wasn't for an organization of other people in uniform, you might not have been able to make it.
I guess the first time I felt that, Tim, was in training. Told you a little while ago that I wasn't an overly gifted athlete. Running was not my friend, and it was a struggle for me. And so I had 31 troop mates, a number of those guys who supported me. And when I was struggling during some of the athletic exercises, they were extremely encouraging to me and motivating to me. And had they not been, I may have left. It was that difficult. And, you know, once you start to get in shape, you know, a couple months in, then, you know, it starts to get a little easier. But during that first couple of months, you know, where I would hear, "Come on, Dad, come on, you can do this, Dad, come on, Dad." You know, that probably was the first time that community support of members was where I really felt it.
In an operational setting, what would have been an example where you'd say, "See, we learned to do this. We learned to rely on each other."
Well, I guess probably some of the you know, more difficult investigations I was involved in. You know, Tim, you know, I was an undercover operator, and I worked on some pretty good undercover files. You know, when our members have been injured or killed on duty, we see support from within the organization that is, again, unless you felt it, you can't explain it. You know, unfortunately, there's been more policemen injured and killed, you know, during my career than almost the entire history of the force in a compressed time period. You're killed violently. You know, you feel it then during those times. Investigationally, I was fortunate enough to have a small role in the undercover operation that brought two people to justice for their part in the murder of four of our members. Probably, if not the biggest, it was one of the biggest, most expensive undercover operations run in the history of the force. There may be more now, but then I think up until that point, it was the longest, most expensive undercover operation run in the history of the force. And the entire team was laser focused on bringing the individuals who had an active role in the murders. They weren't the guys that pulled the trigger, but they had an active role in the homicide of those four members. And so that experience, Tim, really was where I got to see the dedication and the members that were involved in that file would have done it for free. And there were some very doubt, you know, there were some times where things weren't going well.
And for anyone who's not familiar with that file, Dan, why don't you just give a bit of a backstory?
I won't go with any names here, Tim, because I don't have permission to use the names. I mean, sure. I guess the names are in the public domain, but, there was in March 3rd, 2003, four members of the RCMP were gunned down in a Quonset in northern Alberta by a guy by the name of James Roscoe. And James Roscoe took his own life after being confronted by two more members of the RCMP and actually shot by one of them, took his own life. But the investigation revealed that two individuals were actively participated in enabling Roscoe to commit that crime. And so an undercover operation was begun by some hugely dedicated members. And but I think it took along 18 months or more. But ultimately, we were able to gather enough evidence to convict both of these other individuals of second degree murder, which was a feat. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna be honest with you, and I was very proud of the work that the members did. And you want to talk about esprit de corps and dedication? I saw it then. The organization, the profession in general, is a group of committed individuals who basically have each other's back. And you don't see it all the time because it's just a known, you know it, but you really see it at times of great adversity or sadness.
Let's change direction for just a moment, Dan. I know in my career, I've got some stories that are so funny that they pale on the ridiculous and the extraordinary, and people simply can't believe it's a true story. What do you got in your career?
Well, you know, there's some good ones. You know, I'm a guy that I like to have a good time. I think I have a pretty good sense of humor. I like to laugh at myself and I laugh at situations. I can remember a time, again, I won't use names, but there's an individual who became a very highly ranked member in the RCMP, retired as a commanding officer. He and I were instructors together in Regina. One day there was a contest where a cadet was going to have dinner in the dining hall, served by two instructors, myself and this other fellow, and they were going to have dinner with the commanding officer and the sergeant major. Now, if you know sergeant majors, they're not known for sitting down for dinner with cadets. So this is quite a treat. You know, they're going to have a catered dinner in the dining hall at a table with a tablecloth. And so I said to this other fellow, I said, well, we got to look the part, man. If we're going to be serving this dinner, we got to look the part. So we got nice white aprons and we had to go and saw the barber at the depot there, and he parted her hair down the middle and put it over to the sides like slick. And then we say, so, well, we got to have some nice waiter mustaches, some handlebar mustaches. So I tried to find something that we could put these handlebar mustaches on with. And they're like, the dinner was like, you know, half an hour away, and I couldn't find anything, couldn't find any mascara or anything. So I went into the kitchen and I asked the girls at the kitchen, I said, do you have any food coloring? I said, oh, yeah, we have some food coloring here. I said, but, you know, be careful because it might not come off. Like, what are you going to? I said, well, we're going to draw mustaches. So we put these big mustaches on our face with food coloring, right? And so we served the dinner. And, of course, we had these big handlebar mustaches drawn on our face. And we served the dinner. And the cadets got a good laugh. And the CO got a good laugh. Well, this other fella was making a presentation to the commanding officer of the base, the commanding officer of Saskatchewan, and the commissioner. Later on that afternoon on the business continuity, I think it was, for depot. Well, he couldn't get that mustache off. And he wound up scrubbing his face till it was raw. Like, I mean, it was basically bleeding. And instead of having a big black handlebar mustache, he had a blood red handlebar mustache on his face when he made the presentation to the commissioner and the commanding officer. We had some good laughs about that. Like, the commissioner said, what in the hell happened to you, when he saw him at the thing there. So that was pretty funny. We had a lot of good times, actually. I instructed in depot from 95 to 98. Had a great opportunity to, and I'll tell you what, some great police officers come out of there. Some of those cadets that I had are now senior officers in the organization. You know, there's lots of those kinds of stories. I can remember one time my trainer, actually, had a skunk under his deck. And so we said, well, you know, he got a live trap from one of the fish and wildlife guys, but he had no intention of giving this skunk a stay of execution. The skunk was going to meet his maker that day. So anyway, we went and we were working night shifts. So we'd go back and check underneath the shed every once in a while, and geez, about 3 or 4 in the morning, lo and behold, there's a skunk in the trap. So Anyway, he tits a bright idea. He said, well, we'll take it out to the dump. You know, back in those days in rural Alberta, you know, you could probably get away with firing off a round in a dump. You're not nowhere near any kind of a residential area or anything like that. So we took the skunk out to the dump, and he said, okay, so I'm going to open the cage. He said, when he comes out, he says, you let him have it. So I said, okay. And I'm not a big guy. I'm not a hunter. I don't like killing any animals or anything like that. So I wasn't looking forward to dispatching the skunk at all. And so I was sitting there, and I'm a little nervous, right? I was a pretty good shot, but it was dark. Anyway, so he opens up the cage, the cage door, and we wait, and the skunk doesn't come out. It's almost like he knows, right? It's not good out there. So anyway, then he goes and grabs the cage, and he shakes it. Well, out drops the skunk, and I've let off 6 shots, which came nowhere near the skunk. But the skunk let off 1 shot and made a direct hit on both of us. So here we are. The skunk's alive and well, maybe even to this day. I don't know how skunks would work. But we were absolutely putrid. Puke. And of course we have to get back to the attachment, so we drive the police car back. Well, you can imagine what the police car smelled like and how happy the staff sergeant was the next morning.
That's funny.
A lot of good memories. You know, I mean, policing is a career, Tim, where, you know, lots of times we're meeting people on their worst day, you know, sometimes the worst day of their life, and you get to be a first-hand witness to human beings sometimes doing unspeakable things to each other. So a good sense of humor is very helpful.
If I was to put you in front of a bunch of cadets that are starting their career right now, what else would you tell them?
Number one, I'd say have fun. You know, have fun, do what you love. And remember that this is an opportunity for you to have an impact, whether it's on an individual or a group of individuals or a community or more. Remember the huge responsibility that you have, and don't take it lightly. And above all, be proud of what you're doing. It is a honorable profession, despite what you might hear from some of the naysayers and some of the people that are the most vocal nowadays, it seems. It's an honorable profession. It's a necessary profession. And people, the silent majority, support us. This is a good illustration of the silent majority here. You don't hear from the silent majority. That's why they're the silent majority. You only hear from them when you need them. When they really think that they need to show the support, they do. And I can tell you that, you know, when I was a detachment commander in Alberta and those 4 members were murdered, well, I'll tell you, almost immediately, coffee, meals, cards, flowers start showing up in my detachment. I was 165 kilometers from the scene. Every police detachment in Alberta and some even across the country started hearing from their communities and how they shared their grief. And so that's when you realize that those folks are the ones you're doing this for. Those folks are the ones that appreciate what you do, and they're the ones you're doing it for. And the rest of them, you know what? Some of them come around, some of them don't. Don't ever be discouraged by those folks, because they're not the majority.
I remember hearing you say something once to me that really, really stuck. You said, there's no one hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
That's exactly right. There's nobody that detests the actions of a bad police officer more than a good one. And I, as I said, you know, as an undercover operator, I said, I'll work for free to do a dirty or corrupt policeman, you know, because it does so much harm to the profession, right? Whenever somebody does something bad, that's a willful criminal activity. Let's not talk about even the things that happen during an arrest where things go bad or whatever. There are unfortunately been instances where police officers have willfully committed criminal actions, knowing that the action they were committing was for a criminal purpose and for their personal gain. They do such damage to the profession. When the day that comes to light, it just made every other policeman in the profession's job more difficult. Those guys are so few.
That's really great advice, Dan. Thanks a million for being with me today. I really do appreciate it. It was great to chat with you, and it's great to see you again. Look forward to having a coffee real soon.
You bet.
You've been listening to Tim Brody in the show Moving Forward, an offering in relationships, team building, and leadership. Sponsored by the Brodies.ca and the Police Leadership Development Academy of Canada. This episode featured Dan McNutt. He spoke with heart and sincerity about his experiences meeting people on their worst day. He emphasizes the notion of meeting people. It really is about those connections. From where he sits, it really is all about community. And that community is about relationships, and relationships matter. Thanks for listening.